Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Brian Wilson. He's a professor of American religious history in the Department of Comparative Religion at Western Michigan University. And his latest book is entitled John E. Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age. Many of you here in West Michigan will remember John Fetzer as the Potter, if you will, the capo di tutti capi of the Fetzer Broadcasting Company, and the one who started WKZO, both television and AM radio. Many people are not aware that John Fetzer was a man deeply on a spiritual search, and this fascinating book explains just exactly the nooks and crannies that John explored during his life. So we welcome Brian Wilson to the show. A little bit about him. He earned his bachelor's in medical microbiology from Stanford University, and after a stint in the Peace Corps, went on to earn an MA in Hispanic Studies from the Monterey Institute of International Studies, and an MA and PhD in religious studies from the University of California, Santa Barbara. And as I mentioned before, he is currently at Western Michigan University. And he is here now with us, by the magic of telephone, here on Common Threads. Hello again, Brian.
Great to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you. So last week, we pretty much set the stage, talked a little bit about the early life of John Fetzer, his affiliation with Seventh-day Adventism, and then him branching out to discover new ways of looking at the world, the universe, God, everything. And I want to talk about some of the particular expressions, if you will, of these philosophies. Some of them I'm fairly familiar with, and others I've never really done that much study. So help me out here. The first one I'd like to talk about is Swedenborgianism. Is that how you pronounce it? Borgianism?
That's correct.
Okay. Yes. Talk about that, and what was it that attracted John Fetzer to that particular church?
Well, Swedenborgianism came from the writings of a Swedish mystic named Emanuel Swedenborg, who, near the end of his life, began having a series of visions in which he basically left his body and traveled in the cosmos and talked to spirits and angels and entered heaven and hell and really came into the presence of God himself. So the revelations of Swedenborg came to be the kind of founding scriptures of a new church called the Church of the New Jerusalem, which was popular not only in his native Sweden, but in England. And it's through England that Swedenborgianism was brought to the United States in the early 19th century. And it became a fairly popular tradition, especially for some reason in the Northeast and the Upper Midwest. And in fact, one of the most famous Swedenborgian missionaries out there was a guy named John Chapman, who, in addition to handing out Swedenborgian tracts, also, of course, gave people apple seeds. And so Johnny Appleseed, who we remember for the apples, was actually a Swedenborgian missionary. It was popular enough in Michigan that there was a serious attempt to get the state capital named Swedenborg at one point. Of course, they eventually went with Lansing. So people were fascinated by the possibility of these visionary experiences that Swedenborg had talked about. And so he's not only important in his own right, but he was one of the progenitors to spiritualism, which became so popular in this country.
Now, I'm curious. I've not read anything by Swedenborg, but one of the books you mentioned was called Heaven and Hell. Mm-hmm. If he was a monist, what sort of concept of hell would he have? That sounds like separation from the unity.
Well, it's definitely, if you think about the cosmos as having a cosmic center, hell is basically the part of the cosmos that's farthest away. and so is not enjoying the proximity to the great cosmic father or great central sun, as sometimes Swedenborg talked about God. The interesting thing about Swedenborgianism is that he felt that people basically, when they died, because of the way they'd formed their character in life, would essentially sort themselves out voluntarily, either entering heaven or entering hell, just simply because they had certain dispositions that played out in the spirit world. Now, the interesting thing about Swedenborgianism is that he also held out the possibility that people could evolve, essentially, spiritually, after death. And so there was a possibility for people to leave hell and migrate to heaven. And so this idea of spiritual evolution after death becomes a cornerstone of spiritualism and a lot of metaphysical traditions after that.
When I think of religions on the fringe in the history of the United mm-hmm. States, two movements come to mind, the Quakers and the Mormons, because they suffered significant violence upon themselves. Did these other movements have to worry about that as well?
Well, to some degree, but the spiritualists, it's interesting, most of the violence against them was rhetorical. And at least their presence in the Northeast and in the Midwest was fairly pacific. I mean, they had their detractors, but one of the things that spiritualism insisted upon was that you didn't necessarily need to cease being a Christian in order to be a spiritualist. There were some spiritualists who did reject Christianity, but there were quite a few people who considered themselves Christian spiritualists. So they acknowledged just enough of the Christian mainstream that I think they avoided kind of the violence of say, the Mormons. The spiritualists also tended to be much more liberal in their outlook and much more interested in mixing with the larger society, so they weren't seen as a group apart, quite like the Quakers and quite like the Mormons were. So I think that's part of it. Part of the violence against them was theological, but part of it was also theological.
I would suspect that they probably played their hands close to the vest because, and again, I don't know all of the traditions of which you speak very well, but what I suspect is that if you really grilled them and they were as honest as they could be, they mm-hmm. would probably express a belief that Jesus was different in degree, not in kind. See what I'm saying?
Oh, I agree. Yes.
Which is similar to what the LDS preaches, right? I mean, LDS says we can all have our own planets, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But I one thing that I also see is that it was important to John Fetzer, wherever he explored, that Jesus be a part of whatever it was they were doing. And I think for a lot of people reared in the Christian tradition, just the idea that somehow the teachings of Jesus are a part of this, are a part of whatever the movement is. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and for John Fetzer, he never stopped being a Christian of some kind. And in fact, one of his earliest religious experiences was a really powerful experience with Jesus. And this was back when he was a really young child, and he was in an elevator at a local department store. And I'm not sure exactly what happened. This is a story that Fetzer narrated very late in life when he was in his 80s. And he talked about how something happened in the elevator that scared him, and then he looked up and he saw a vision of Jesus, and he found himself holding on to Jesus' leg. And Jesus basically said, "I will never let you go." And from that point on, Jesus continued, even after he left Christianity, even after he left Seventh-day Adventism, Jesus continued to play an important role in his spiritual development. Now, he adopted a much more kind of metaphysical notion of who Jesus was and what his mission was. And later in life, he would more often talk about Christ consciousness than necessarily Jesus as a kind of personal figure. So over time, Jesus for him became much more like almost the presence of God in the universe, almost like the Holy Spirit would kind of function in traditional Christianity. But the life of Jesus really retained its importance for him as well, because he was both a great ethical exemplar, but he also had powers to heal, which in the metaphysical community is seen as a psychic power, which, of course, Orthodox Christians reject. It's the grace of God. But for him, Jesus fit very easily into his evolving metaphysical worldview.
You mentioned his attraction to Eastern religions, Hinduism, Buddhism. Was there any other East Taoism? Where did he find a place to explore or places to explore in Asian religions?
Well, I think his earliest exposure to Asian religions came through his readings of Theosophy. And Theosophy is another one of these 19th century traditions that arose in the United States. And it was the brainchild of Colonel Olcott, who was a Civil War colonel and lawyer, and Madame Blavatsky, who was a medium, originally from the Ukraine, but who had traveled extensively throughout her life. And the two of them came together in New York City at a certain point because they were interested in spiritualism. But they decided ultimately to create the Theosophical Society, which would be an attempt to marry or to harmonize Western esoteric thought with Hinduism and Buddhism. So the writings of Blavatsky and her followers were filled with information about Hinduism and Buddhism. And so I think that's where John Fetzer originally was exposed to these traditions. And then later, he did a round-the-world trip, which took him to East Asia and South Asia. And he took the opportunity, especially in South Asia, to visit all sorts of shrines and temples and to talk to holy men and pundits of all kinds. And so I think there, that really kind of sparked his interest in Eastern traditions in and of themselves.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella. My guest today is Professor Brian Wilson from Western Michigan University. We're talking about his book, John E. Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age. I'm curious if you know two of the most popular Hindu thought leaders who came to the United States were Swamis Vivekananda and Yogananda. And I'm wondering if you know if he had any, he would be too young to have even, to have been alive when Vivekananda was.
Right.
All right. But Yogananda, they were contemporaries. Do you know if he had any affiliation whatsoever with their movements?
Well, he didn't have a direct affiliation, but I believe it was Yogananda who wrote Autobiography of a Yogi.
Correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's found in John Fetzer's library. So he definitely knew about Yogananda and was interested in Vedanta in general, but he never actually had he never belonged to a Vedanta society.
I see. And, of course, it's interesting there that both Vivekananda and Yogananda very often referred to the teachings of Jesus as they were expounding their Hindu philosophies. So certainly that go on.
And well, one of the interesting things that John Fetzer was so interested in was the lost years of Jesus. And there's all sorts of mythology that's grown up about what Jesus was doing between his childhood and his ministry.
Yes.
And there are a number of esoteric texts, especially the Aquarian Gospel of Jesus by Levi Dowling, which is a channeled text, which purports to tell the tale of Jesus basically heading east and studying with the Greeks and studying with the Persians, and then finally studying with the Hindus and Buddhists. So this idea of this meeting of East and West, especially through the kind of the personality of Jesus, really was captivating for John Fetzer.
I'm sure. Another thing that you write about that's interesting is the Ouija board. So can you tell us, was there an evolution from Ouija board as game to Ouija board as an actual spiritual practice, or was it always kind of a mix of the two?
Well, originally, the Ouija board was a tool for contacting the spirits. And, for example, going all the way back to the Fox sisters that we talked about earlier, the Fox sisters basically heard a series of raps, and they interpreted this to be a sound made by a spirit. Now, the problem was, how do you communicate with the spirit? So they came up with a very crude kind of code, a way of decoding the raps and taps that they were hearing. And this was by creating essentially an alphabet board that had the alphabet listed on it. And as a letter was pointed to, you would either hear two raps for no or one rap for yes or vice versa. And so the Ouija board actually started out as a very crude way of contacting the spirits. And then later in, I forget exactly when, late 19th, early 20th century, it was marketed as a parlor game. And at that point, it became both an entertainment and also a kind of technology to reach the spirits. And from then on, it's continued to be a very popular game slash, I don't know what you want to call it, metaphysical device, if you will.
You write in the book that Fetzer used it, and he actually made business decisions with it, but he was careful never to use it alone, lest it evoke powers he could not control.
Mm-hmm.
What powers, what does that mean, I guess? What's the difference between using it on your own and using it with someone else?
Well, there's an idea surrounding the Ouija board that it opens you up to the spiritual world in general, and that there are good spirits and there are bad spirits, depending on, you know, who you're talking to. And this is something that spiritualist mediums often talked about, that they had to be careful to avoid the evil spirits out there and to contact simply the good spirits. And so this kind of mythology of the Ouija board was that if you used it alone, you ran the risk of opening yourself more easily to these negative or evil spirits out there. And so John Fetzer believed this. And so he always worked the Ouija board with his confidential secretary and made sure that, you know, there was always at least two people when they were doing it. And precisely for that reason, to contact the good spirits and hopefully not contact the evil spirits.
You know, I had an experience with a Ouija board once. I've never been able to explain to anyone, but this is, it's anecdotal, but it happened to me. So I had a couple of friends, a brother and sister. They had a Ouija board, and we were always playing on it. And I remember sometimes getting some sort of answer that really seemed impressive, but this one blew me out of the water. The brother and the sister were manning the board, if you will. And I asked the question, I'm probably in fifth or sixth grade, and I said, is there any girl in my class who likes me? And obviously, I mean, like, right? And lo and behold, they spell out C-A-N-D-A-C-E, Candace. And yes, there was a girl in my class named Candace, and I knew that she liked me. I had no passionate feelings for Candace. I was really hoping that any other name but Candace was going to come up. But neither the brother nor the sister went to my school. I never mentioned the existence of Candace. And even when Candace was spelled out, I just kind of shrugged my shoulders like, Mm-hmm. Who that is. But I know that Candace liked me in fifth grade or sixth grade, whatever it was. So that's my experience with the Ouija board. Maybe it was an evil spirit. I don't
Who knows? Maybe a trickster spirit out there.
That's true. But it stayed with me all these years. One thing you describe Fetzer in your book as a conservative businessman. So mm-hmm. was he conservative in the terms that we normally think about? Did he normally vote Republican as opposed to Democrat? How did he feel about social policies, et cetera, et cetera? Do we know much about that?
Well, we know some. He was politically conservative, voted Republican, as far as I can tell. Although his earliest experiences in Washington during the 1930s, he met a number of prominent Democrats like FDR and Harry Truman. So he had friends on both sides of the aisle, but I think he was temperamentally really inclined towards a more conservative Republican position. However, one of the interesting things is during the 1960s and 70s, he wrote a couple of essays about contemporary conditions. And especially the essay he published in his genealogy in 1972, he called it America's Agony because he was really concerned about the kind of political and social divisions of the country that had developed over the 1960s. And I would have expected him to be very harsh about, for example, the student protests against the Vietnam War or the rise of the hippies. And he actually wasn't. He tried very hard to kind of get into the mind of young people of his day, and he found a lot of what they were saying, it resonated with what he thought, that technology had come to control people, people weren't controlling technology, there was way too much materialism in the world, and this coming from a man who basically made millions off of technology. So although he was politically conservative, nevertheless, I think on some social issues, he was quite broad-minded. And I think this is part of his kind of his spiritual openness, his willingness to basically explore and try and see multiple sides.
And I'm sure that if he had conversations with some of the hippies, because as we know, it wasn't a monolithic movement, but certainly some mm-hmm. of the hippies were exploring the same kinds of spirituality as he was.
Yes, and indeed a lot of what came to be the New Age came out of the 1960s hippie counterculture. A lot of the things that got validated during the 60s wound up becoming kind of quasi-institutionalized in the New Age movement in the 1980s. So yes, I think he recognized among this younger generation an openness, especially to kind of metaphysical things that he was interested in. So yes, there were connecting threads, common causes.
If you could sum up the work that the Institute is doing now, the John Fetzer mm-hmm. Institute, give me your take on that. Briefly.
Well, John Fetzer was very interested in individual spiritual development, but he always believed that individual spiritual development had to contribute to a greater kind of social spiritual development. And in fact, he was looking for a kind of global spiritual transformation. And that's what he hoped his institute would ultimately help to catalyze. And so today, the foundation's mission, its slogan, is essentially to create the foundations for a loving world. And the idea is they basically support a variety of different organizations and groups that are promoting spirituality broadly conceived throughout the life cycle, from childhood to old age. And so they continue John Fetzer's concern with individual spiritual development, but with this larger idea that they're contributing to an eventual, gradual, global spiritual transformation.
If people want to know more about first of all, your work. Do you have a website, Brian?
Well, they can go to the Department of Comparative Religion at Western Michigan University, and they'll find a directory, and there they will find my personal website, which talks about not only my publications, but this also might be of interest, the kinds of courses I teach at Western Michigan.
Oh, okay. Great. And how about for Fetzer Institute itself?
Well, there are a couple of different places. For the Fetzer Institute itself, you can go to fetzer.org, and that website will tell you about the kinds of programs that the Fetzer Institute is supporting. And in terms of the Memorial Trust, which originally commissioned the book on John Fetzer, you can go to infinitepotential.com. And there you can download a free PDF of the preface and first chapter of the book to give you a kind of taste of what the book is all about.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Well, Brian, we're out of time again. I want to thank you so very much for your time with us today and last week as well.
My pleasure. It's been a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and my guest today has been Professor Brian Wilson from Western Michigan University, the author of John E. Fetzer and the Quest for the New Age. Please join us again next week here on Common Threads.